headlines, Iran warns against interference in the IAEA's duties, saying an agreement is within reach if all parties adhere to commitments and not to threats. Palestinians hold funerals for two of their fellow citizens who were killed by the Israeli army in the past 24 hours in the occupied West Bank. And the United Nations says the warring parties in Yemen have agreed to renew their truce for another 2 months. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Iran's foreign minister warns against unconstructive interference in the duties of the International Atomic Energy Agency. In a phone conversation with Singapore's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian pointed to Iran's cooperation with the IAEA. He said the agency's reports have verified the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear program and that hasty political comments cannot deter its progress. He also pointed to a mutually satisfactory agreement that was made during IAEA Director Rafael Grossi's recent visit to Tehran. According to the top diplomat, Iran is serious about making a good deal and that an agreement is available if all parties adhere to diplomacy instead of threats. China has warned any confrontational moves at the upcoming meeting of the IAEA Board of Governors will only undermine cooperation between Iran and the agency and disrupt the negotiation process on the revival of the 2015 deal. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman made these comments after reports said that the U.S., the U.K., and France and Germany have prepared a draft resolution to push the Board of Governors to rebuke Iran at the board's June the 6th meeting. Liao Xiang said that exerting pressure on Iran and the UN agency will escalate tensions and complicate the situation. He called on Washington to make a political decision as soon as possible on the revival of the agreement known as the JCPOA. The official urged the White House to actively respond to what he called Iran's legitimate concerns and work towards an early consensus on outstanding issues. Political commentator Alfred Desaia says the United States, Britain, and Israel manipulate UN agencies like the IAEA in an attempt to achieve their anti-Iran goals.
Well, double standards are not uncommon in the UN system, and UN reports are not always balanced. They are subject to being weaponized against certain countries and not against others. Now, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT of 1970, as you know, there are 191 state bodies. Iran is the state body, not, however, Israel, India, Pakistan, North Korea. So it's not universal. And Article 10 of the NPT would allow Iran to denounce the treaty if it wants to, if it feels that its national security is at stake. Now, nobody wants that. United States intelligence services, United Kingdom, Israeli, we all work hand in hand. They have one goal, and that is to have regime change in Tehran. So anything that might destabilize, anything that might, diminish the influence of Iran in world affairs is welcome. And for that purpose, you use whatever agencies, United Nations agencies and other agencies, and of course, the media.
Israeli troops have shot dead a Palestinian man during a raid in the occupied West Bank as regime forces step up deadly attacks against Palestinians. Ayman Masian, a 29-year-old father of three, was killed when regime forces raided a refugee camp in Bethlehem. He was the third Palestinian killed in 24 hours after a woman was shot early on Wednesday and a man was killed in an Israeli raid on the town of Yabad near Jenin later in the day. Six Palestinians were also injured during the attacks. In the meantime, hundreds of people held funerals for two of the Palestinians killed on Wednesday. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry has called on the International Criminal Court to break its silence over Israel's crimes. And also, we have some news coming in right now. As you can see on the screen, the Health Ministry has announced that a Palestinian teenager has also been shot dead by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. We'll be bringing you more details on that.
The Israeli regime is pressing ahead with its barbaric violence against Palestinians. Israeli military forces have shot and killed a Palestinian woman in the southern part of the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry identified the 31-year-old victim as Ghufran Haroun Hamed Warasne. The Tel Aviv regime claims the woman was trying to stab Israeli soldiers, but witnesses say that Warasne posed little threat to the soldiers. She has started a new job at a radio station 3 days prior to being killed.
This woman was apparently also a journalist, starting her first day of work. And it's hard for me to believe that this was someone attacking Israelis. This is an excuse. If they produced a knife, I can't imagine that it was the woman who had the wife. It was produced by the Israelis themselves.
The incident happened close to the Al-Arub refugee camp, located 15 kilometers south of Bethlehem. The Palestine Red Crescent Society said the Israeli forces prevented its medical staff from attending to Warasne. They only managed to attend her 20 minutes after she was injured. The killing comes amid rising tensions between Palestinians and Israeli forces in the occupied territories. Local and international rights groups have condemned what they call Israel's excessive use of force and shoot-to-kill policy against Palestinians.
They're being protected. The Israelis are being protected in the U.S. and most likely the rest of the Western countries. So are they being reckless? Well, if you live in a part of the world where you get the full information, yes, I think you could say that they're being reckless. But in fact, they're being permitted to continue their genocide and their recklessness without being held to account. This is the problem.
The United Nations says Yemen's warring sides have agreed to renew a two-month truce brokered at the start of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan to soothe the humanitarian situation in the country. The UN Special Envoy for Yemen says the ceasefire, which was set to expire on Thursday, has been extended for two more months. Under the armistice, which went into effect on April the 2nd, the warring sides agreed to halt all offensive operations, including cross-border attacks. The Saudi-led coalition had also agreed to end its simultaneous siege of the impoverished country, but Yemen has time and again accused the coalition of violating the truce. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched the war on Yemen in March 2015. The conflict has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and led to the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The leader of Yemen's popular Ansar Allah movement says resistance is the only path to victory against the enemies of the country. Abdelmalek al-Houthi said standing up to enemies is a religious duty. He accused the United States of seeking to control Yemen in order to loot its resources. He said Washington has been targeting all of the country in all areas, political, economy, security, and culture. Houthi says the U.S. and its allies restored military action after losing hope of controlling the country politically, but still they have failed to achieve their goals due to the steadfast resistance of the Yemeni nation. Ansar Allah leader said the Yemeni people will not give in to any campaign against their country. He also censured some regional states for working hand-in-hand with the U.S. and Israel in trying to implement vicious plots against Muslim nations. Turkish troops have intensified artillery attacks on towns and villages in northern Syria since last night. The offensive has reportedly caused material damage to the civilian population. Earlier, we talked to our correspondent, Muhammad Ali, for the details.
According to state media outlets over here, Turkey shelled several villages in and around an area called Abu Rasin in Hasake's northern countryside, resulting in the injury of a number of people and some damages in the public and private properties, mainly people's houses over there in Abu Rasin. Now, this comes, of course, following statements by Turkey that it will carry out a military operation in northern Syria in order to push away the threat of what it calls terrorists, meaning the so-called Syria's Democratic Forces, which is mainly led by the YPG, the Kurdish People's Protection Units, which Turkey regards as terrorists. Also, we have to point out that the Syrian government is, of course, against such a military operation. Eventually, this is an aggression on Syria. It's an attack. This is not the first. This is the fourth, of course, Turkish military operation on Syria since 2016. Syria always, Syrian officials accuse and say that the Turkish government directly supports terrorist groups inside Syria and is looking for its own interests.
Major oil producers headed by Saudi Arabia and Russia have agreed to pump more oil to offset Russian output loses amid surging prices. OPEC said it had agreed to boost output by 648,000 barrels per day. The amount was more than expected. The increase comes after months of pressure from the West to address global energy shortages worsened by Western sanctions on Russia over the war in Ukraine. Oil prices have risen on the news towards $117, and that is because analysts say the real production boost will be insignificant, as most OPEC members, except for Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, are already pumping at capacity. The United States welcomed the decision by OPEC Plus and recognized the role of Saudi Arabia. This as Joe Biden is to visit Riyadh later this month for the first time as U.S. president. Moscow has warned the European Union's decision to partially phase out Russian oil is, quote, self-destructive step that could backfire. Russia's foreign ministry said Brussels and Washington would have to take responsibility for the worsening circumstances surrounding global food and energy. The ministry accuses the EU of taking illegitimate action against Russia. The Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says the oil ban would hurt global oil flows and destabilize energy markets. The EU leaders have already agreed in theory to cut 90% of Russian oil imports by the end of this year as part of the sixth round of sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine. Moscow says such measures would eventually harm the EU's economy. French unions took to the streets around the country as new data shows that France's economy has reached record lows. France's penchant for protesting seems to be dwindling despite the widespread economic hardship. Ramin Mazahari reports.
For the first time since the presidential vote, France's unions marched nationwide, as the nation's public services will likely be under major attack for the next 5 years. Polls show President Emmanuel Macron will likely have almost as strong a grip over parliament as in his first term.
Unions repeatedly warned that the coronavirus was being instrumentalized to accelerate the long-standing neoliberal goal of defunding public services. Now they face a re-elected Macron who could be more powerful and confrontational than ever.
Macron's policies have meant the ending of so many social services and not replacing public servants who retire. This means those still working are doing double the amount of work as before, and that has led to burnout, illness, and even suicide attempts. If Macron would come talk to us, he would see that we are not being treated fairly, but I doubt he will.
New data shows the French economy has stagnated to the brink of a recession. Inflation in the Eurozone just hit its highest annual level since the currency began in 1999. That combination spells stagflation, something for which liberal economics has no theoretical remedy, and it comes after a decade of austerity measures which were allegedly supposed to strengthen the eurozone.
The inflation index point has not been changed in a decade for civil servants, so our salaries have been constantly falling, and this was before this year's record increase in inflation. On top of this, they are asking us to work longer for the same pay, so our hourly wage is being reduced and we have less time away from work to be with our family and friends.
Despite the new lows in economic data, unions were not able to draw as many to march as in years past. Since the coronavirus restrictions began to be lifted last fall, many have noted that French protests are occurring less often and are smaller in size. It could be that, after a decade of mostly failed labor efforts, workers simply can't afford to miss work anymore. Or many have given up trying to influence Brussels or the French government. Or many French could be too scared to protest given what happened to the Yellow Vests. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Iran's health ministry says there have been no COVID-19-related deaths over the past 24 hours, a remarkable first in the country since the pandemic emerged in 2019. The total number of deaths stands at over 141,000. The ministry recorded 175 new infections in the past 24 hours. Health authorities are attributing the low numbers to the massive vaccination drive. They say the intensive nationwide campaign is now paying off. So far, nearly 150 million doses have been administered across the country, and nearly 60 million Iranians have been fully inoculated.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
After watching the tragedy at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, unfold after so many other shootings in recent weeks, I'm wondering what I might have missed when I was asked to start the FBI's active shooter program 10 years ago. Did I have my team focus on the wrong problems? Did I spend my budget wisely to find ways to save lives? The article you're about to hear has been written by Catherine Schwait, an FBI special agent who created and ran the agency's active shooter program after the shootings at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut in 2012. Catherine Schwait retired in 2017 after 20 years of service. The article has been published in the opinion section of the New York Times and is titled, "I Created the FBI's Active Shooter Program. The officers in Uvalde did not follow their training." After watching the tragedy at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, unfold after so many other shooting incidents in recent weeks, I'm wondering what I might have missed when I was asked to start the FBI's active shooter program 10 years ago. Did I have my team focus on the wrong problems? Did I spend my budget wisely to find ways to save lives? Every shooting is evaluated in three parts. How could we have prevented the shooting? Did we respond effectively to save lives? And how are we helping the community to recover? Last Monday, the FBI designated 61 shooting incidents in 2021 as active shooter attacks, up from 40 in 2020, and 30 incidents in 2019. We aren't preventing the shootings, I realized. Perhaps I thought we were doing better in responding to the attacks as they unfolded. But if the 78 minutes that the police in Uvalde, Texas waited before confronting the gunman at the Robb Elementary School are any indication, the answer is, we are not. Waiting so long, the director of the Texas Department of Public Safety said on Friday, was the wrong decision, period. So why did the police leadership make that call? In the first few years after the massacre at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut in December of 2012, the FBI spent more than $30 million to send agents to police departments around the country. The goal was to train local police officers in how to handle active shooter incidents so they would know how to go after a shooter with confidence and neutralize the threat. The day after the FBI released its latest active shooter figures, the Robb Elementary School was attacked. In the past 2 years, the Uvalde School District has hosted at least two active shooter trainings, according to reporting by the New York Times. One of them was 2 months ago. Current protocol and best practices say officers must persistently pursue efforts to neutralize a shooter when a shooting is underway. This is true even if only one officer is present. This is without question the right approach. We need to understand why that protocol was not followed in Uvalde, Texas. I'm still confident the FBI's focus on training to this standard was right. But I'm less confident in its execution. The police officers who responded may have been unprepared for conflict, which can lead to fatal results. Law enforcement officers need to be mentally prepared before they arrive on the scene, so they can respond immediately. Repetitive training builds practice and confidence. Big gatherings for training every few years are more expensive and less effective for muscle memory. Instead, departments should consider more virtual tabletop exercises they can run through in an afternoon. Have police officers walk through schools and talk with one another about how they would respond. Require police officers to check all their gear before they begin a shift. Last year, active shooters killed 103 people and injured 140 others in 30 states. 5 of those attacks were in Texas. Most of our more than 800,000 law enforcement officers in the United States are in small departments. This is not the first time a law enforcement agency has failed in the way it responded. At times, training can become routine and be taken less seriously in any environment, but agencies should be careful to avoid complacency. Are they undertaking the training to check a box? Police department leaders need to tell their officers today what is expected of them and to understand that Americans demand it. We also need to reevaluate how we advise students and teachers to react when an active shooter enters a school. After the Sandy Hook incident, the federal government adopted the Run, Hide, Fight model, which instructs students and teachers to run first if they can, then hide if they must, and finally, fight to survive. Today's schools, at best, are giving lip service to the first part of that mantra, to run. Most schools that train for a shooting incident urge their students, teachers, and other staff members to lock out or hide from a shooter, but almost never to run for their lives if they can. My friend Frank DeAngelis, a retired principal of Columbine High School in Colorado, told me he wished his students and faculty had been taught to flee. At Sandy Hook, 9 first graders survived when they were able to flee their classroom, thanks to their brave teacher, Victoria Lee Soto, who was shot and killed when she stood in front of the killer. I still have nightmares about details from school shootings in which survivors told me they huddled under their desks, hoping against logic that the shooter would not see them. It's hard to shed the images of victims' bodies found huddled under plastic tables, behind cloth partitions, or together in a group against the wall. I remember telling my children that if someone approached them in a car while they were walking, they should run as fast as they can and as far as possible. Yet in many school settings, we have mistakenly discouraged students from trying their best to simply stay alive. Now my youngest child is a teacher whose middle school classroom is near the end of a hall with a side door to the outside. The classrooms are filled with desks. She knows that killers who strike schools will take advantage of opportunities to find more victims. I share my daughter's experience not to invite criticism of the actions of educators responding to lethal situations, but to underscore how vital proper training is to the survival of teachers and their students. We're told the best way to learn is from the mistakes that we make. According to data from the FBI, in recent years, the average number of casualties per active shooter attack has declined, even as the number of attacks has actually increased. I think this reflects better policing and improved public awareness. Still, police will not likely be there in the critical first minutes of an attack on a school. In the aftermath of the wrenching tragedy in Uvalde, Texas, it's clear that nearly 10 years after the Sandy Hook incident, we must ask ourselves if the training designed to safeguard us against killers in our schools is the training that is working.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of RIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters in Islam, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. I want to give a reminder to all of us, first myself, about the significance of the time that we are just entered. Dhul Qa'dah is the first of the haram months, the very special spiritual months. Kind of lets us know how important, how special this month is First the birthday of Lady Masuma, then the birthday of Imam Ridha. Now, she is so special. I would like to talk about her a little bit. She is so special that her grandfather, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he prophesied her birth. This lets you know that this is somebody who's special, who's about to come into this world. That Qum became the haram of the Ahlul Bayt because of Sayyidah Masuma. Again, there's no time. Each one of these events are so important that it would be nice to talk about. There's no time for us to get a true understanding of her status with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But let me share an anecdote from her life. So what happens is, once some of the Shia from Qum came to visit Imam Kadhim alayhi salam, and the Imam is in Medina, right? The Imam is living in Medina. The Shia have come from Qum, and they're over there to visit and pay their respects to the Imam. They have two things that they want to do with this visit. One of them is the money of the Imam. Khums is an obligation, brothers and sisters. Our Shia, at that time, they wanted to hand deliver their khums to the Imam. One of the things. The other one was that they also had some important religious questions. Now, it so happened that they had traveled all this way and they come to Medina and the Imam's traveling. He's out of town. No luck. They hand the monies over and they leave the questions. They write down, you have a list of questions, religious queries. We would love to get those from the Imam. They give them to the family of the Imam. And they had to leave. Hazrat Masuma, salamullah alayha, is about 8 or 9 at this time. These people are in a rush. They have to go back. How long does it take to travel from Medina to Qum? At that time, you came for your questions. She took that list of questions and answered each and every one of them and then gave them to the brothers. The brothers leave. On the way, they end up meeting their Imam, Imam Kadhim. They met him in the way. And the Imam sees the questions and the answers 100% correct. From a girl 8 or 9 years old. And the Imam said 3 times, Fidaha Abuha, may her father be her ransom. That's not a small thing for an Imam to say. May I be sacrificed for you. Now, our greats, our ulama, you should see what they are like when it comes to the haram of Hazrat Masuma. Inshallah, you all get the chance to make ziyarah, to go over there to benefit. You hear from Ayatollah Behjat and others that even if you want to go and visit Imam Ridha, go to Qum. Ask her to talk to her brother on your behalf and vice versa. One of the things that Shaheed Mutahhari explains about Allama Tabatabai, just so we can again get an idea of how, what a status this young lady had. He says that Allama Tabatabai, that Arif, he would break his fast by kissing the dhari of Hazrat Masuma. How? He, on the month of Ramadan, he would walk from his home. It's going to be close to the time of iftar. I'm going to go over and break my fast. Before he would break his fast, he would walk from his house to the shrine of Lady Masuma, kiss the dhari, and then he would go back and have his food. These are these kind of people. So I'm hoping, brothers and sisters, that when you do go and visit her, you don't take this as a small, ordinary visit and not ask for your great needs. No, ask for your big needs from Hazrat Masuma, inshallah. Brothers and sisters, there's also a few reminders about the month that I would like us, first of all for myself, but also brothers and sisters, to take advantage of. One of them is that I encourage brothers and sisters this Sunday, if you can, if you have the tawfiq, this Sunday there's a prayer, a very short prayer, but it has amazing spiritual effects. Incredible spiritual effects. If you miss it on Sunday, don't abandon hope. Even the rest of the month you can still do it. But ideally, if you can, the prayer is the prayer. You can look in Mufatil al-Janan. The prayer for the first Sunday of Dhul-Qa'dah. I'll just mention a little bit of some of the rewards, because sometimes what happens, we'll hear the Urafa have told us to do this. It might not strike us at how important this is. So a little bit what we find in the hadith. If you do this prayer, if Allah gives you the tawfiq, on that Sunday you perform it, a voice will call out from heaven, restart your a'mal. Restart your a'mal. Your tawbah has been accepted, your sins have been forgiven. One of the malaika will call out from under the throne of Allah, You and your family, meaning your progeny, have been blessed. Another one will call out that, let's say you had khusama, there were people who had problems with you, maybe you had some haqqunas, things that you didn't do right, people were upset with you, on the day of judgment, they will be pleased with you if you do this prayer. You will die with faith. Your iman, your deen will not be taken away from you. Your grave will be expanded and become full of light. Let's say my parents weren't pleased with me. God forbid. We definitely want to make sure the spiritual month that our parents are pleased with us. Let's say my parents passed and they weren't pleased with me, then they will become pleased with me. Allah promises that. And your children will be forgiven for your sake. You do this amal, your children are forgiven. You'll have expansive rizq, Allah's provision, in this world and the next. An angel Jibra'il, the archangel, he will say that when the angel of death comes to visit you, comes to take your soul, I, angel Jibra'il, will come with him to ensure that he takes your soul gently. So these are just a few of the blessings of this month. The 23rd, brothers and sisters, if you have the tawfiq, if you can, it's a special day for performing even a short ziyara of Imam Ridha, the 23rd. The 25th of this month is what we call Dahwul Ard. One of the Shia says, I was a little child and I went with my father. We went to visit Imam Ridha alayhi salam, and he told us a little bit about the significance of Dahwul Ard. He said that this is the day, 25th. That's when Prophet Ibrahim and Isa were born. Nabi Ibrahim and Nabi Isa alayhim as-salam. He said that the earth appeared from under the Kaaba and it spread, Dahwul Ard, on that day. What should we do on that day? Brothers and sisters, this is one of the 4 days out of the year to fast. Let's say I have a qadha fast from the month of Ramadan, and I want to make it up. You can make it up, a wajib fast, on that day, and you get the reward of the mustahab fast. What's the reward for fasting on the day of Dahwul Ard? 70 years of fasting. 70 years of fasting. And of course, the very best thing, because I mean, ghusl, ibadah, those are things that you do on that day. But the very best thing that you and I can do on that day, brothers and sisters, is the ziyarah of Imam Ridha alayhi salam.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Ali. حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صل عليه.
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
In the United States, children of temporary visa holders who can't gain permanent residency in the U.S. are one of several groups urging the Biden administration to act on an immigration overhaul. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Aishwarya Kavi. The piece is titled, "They Grew Up Legally in the U.S. but Can't Stay After They Turn 21. In 2011, after 5 years of working and living with his family in the United States on a temporary visa, Bharathi Mohan Ganesan submitted green card applications for his wife, his 5-year-old daughter, and his 11-year-old son. Mr. Ganesan, who was born in India and has also lived in Singapore and Australia, was nervous about when his wife and children might gain permanent residency of the United States. He knew the waiting list was especially long for Indians on his kind of visa, an H-1B, which allows American companies to employ skilled foreign workers. Because of chronic backlogs, it can take years to process those on work visas who apply for permanent residency. Last year, a decade after he applied, Mr. Ganesan, his wife and his daughter received their green cards. But his son had turned 21 and missed the cutoff by a matter of a few months, leaving him scrambling for a visa that would allow him to stay in the United States. Mr. Ganesan's son is among more than 200,000 children who grew up in the United States under the protection of their parents' temporary visas, which can be renewed indefinitely. But the children risk losing their legal status when they turn 21. Unable to become permanent residents of the United States because of the backlogs or because they were never eligible in the first place, they must obtain a different visa, remain in the United States without legal status, or leave the country entirely. According to the Cato Institute, more than 10,000 children aged out of green card eligibility each year. Untold numbers eventually depart the United States, often leaving their families behind. These young people do not qualify for the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA program, created by executive action during the Obama administration. The DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, protects from deportation about 650,000 youths, or DREAMers, who were brought into the United States and have remained without legal status. Because the program requires applicants to be undocumented, it does not offer those with legal status a way to stay in the United States. A comprehensive immigration overhaul is highly unlikely to pass a deadlocked Congress in a midterm election year. The Biden administration has been under increasing pressure as a Trump-era public health order, known as Title 42, is set to be lifted in late May, a move that is expected to create a surge of migration across the southwestern border of the United States. A bipartisan group of senators restarted immigration discussions on Thursday, 28th of April, to try to identify standalone proposals that would have the support of both political parties. When asked on Thursday, 28th of April, whether the Biden administration, which is updating the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, the DACA program, was considering extending protections to documented youth, Alejandro Mayorkas, the Homeland Security Secretary, told the House Judiciary Committee that the department did not plan to do so. Its focus was to fortify the existing DACA program and shift responsibility for documented youth to Congress, he said, adding that their situation spoke to the imperative to pass immigration reform. In interviews, more than a dozen people who lived in the United States on temporary visas from a young age described their struggles with anxiety and the financial burden of navigating how to remain in the country they considered home. They are urging the Biden administration, if it will not provide a path to citizenship, to offer a way for them to legally remain in the country. Mr. Ganesan's son, Niranjan Bharathimohan, is able to stay in the United States until this November only because immigration officials extended his dependent visa. Mr. Bharathimohan, a student at the University of Texas at Dallas, will have to go to Singapore, where he was born, to apply for a student visa that will allow him to return to the United States and finish his degree. His application might be rejected since he previously tried for a green card. He has shown an intent to immigrate to the United States, which is not allowed. Applicants may be asked to show that they intend to leave the country after completing their courses. Mr. Bharathimohan faces the prospect of being stuck in Singapore, where he has no family and no roots. How is he going to manage alone? Mr. Ganesan said. I was really devastated that just because of my country of birth, my son's opportunities are very limited in the United States. While there are protections to keep families together when parents move to the United States on temporary work visas, those end when children turn 21, because they are no longer considered part of the family unit. I don't think people who originally wrote the laws foresaw a situation where children brought here on visas would be raised and educated here, but not have a clear opportunity to stay and become American citizens, said Dip Patel, the founder of Improve the Dream, an organization that campaigns for a path to citizenship for those children. Dip Patel added, delay in taking action will not only lead to tearing more families apart, but also continue the immense emotional turmoil faced by thousands of families. At a Senate hearing in March, Senator Richard Durbin, Democrat of Illinois and the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and Senator John Cornyn of Texas, the top Republican on the panel's Immigration Subcommittee, vowed to work on legislation to help people who had grown up in the United States without a clear path to U.S. citizenship. Muzaffar Chishti, the director of the Migration Policy Institute at the New York University School of Law, described the issue as one of many in a system that has not been truly updated since the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1952, which established the pathways for legal immigration to the United States that are still in place. Short of a legislative overhaul of the system, Improve the Dream, the advocacy group, has worked to increase awareness of the issue and is urging the Biden administration to make changes. But children of non-immigrant visa holders have criticized the Biden administration for being too slow or unwilling to take action on proposed changes, such as the expansion of the DACA program to include documented youths. Among the proposals is one that would modify how U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services determines whether an applicant qualifies for a green card, allowing more children and minors to remain eligible as they near the age of 21. Another would classify applicants as children beyond their 21st birthday to keep them in line for a green card, which is the policy for those who are refugees or asylum seekers or are sponsored by relatives who are U.S. citizens. Matthew Burke, a spokesman for the Immigration Agency, said the Department of Homeland Security was keenly aware of the challenges for documented youths in the United States and was exploring legal methods to provide immigration relief to this population where possible.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on May 7th, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution on the occasion of the International Al-Quds Day. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, in his speech on the occasion of International Quds Day, referring to the change in the balance of power in favor of Islamic world and Palestine, emphasized, I tell you with confidence the downward movement of the Zionist regime has started and will not stop.
I tell you with confidence, these attempts will not get them anywhere. The downward movement of the Zionist enemy has started and it will not stop moving downward. The decisive factors in the future, the continued activities of the resistance in the occupied lands and Muslims, support for the Palestinian Mujahids. There are two determining factors in the future. First and foremost is the continued activities of resistance in the Palestinian lands and the strengthening of the line of jihad and martyrdom. And second, global support on the part of governments and Muslim nations throughout the world for the Palestinian Mujahids. All of us, government officials, intellectuals, religious scholars, political parties and groups, the brave youths and people of various social backgrounds should determine our position in this public movement and play our part.
Every day we tell each other that this day will be the last and tomorrow. All can go home free, and all this will finally end. Palestine tomorrow. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free.
This is what nullifies the enemy's plots, and it will be an apocalyptic manifestation of this Quranic verse. Or do they intend a plot? But those who defy Allah are themselves involved in a plot. The Holy Quran, chapter 52, verse 42. And Allah has full power and control over His affairs, but most among mankind do not know. The Holy Quran, chapter 12, verse 21.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.